person out there is selling a bit, which causes the market to go down. And when that happens, when the market goes down, there's some people who sell simply because the market goes down. There are people who apparently intensely believe in selling low and buying high. They have such an intense belief in that that they do it with alarming regularity and manage to lose tremendous amounts of money in the process. But that's okay, because the rest of us, the ones who stay invested, have a tendency to make money off the fact that they lose money. It is, to some degree, a zero balance game out there. And it always helps when people are vigorously losing their money because somebody else is vigorously making money at the same time.
Yes, I'm just now sitting down behind the microphone, finally, Jake speaking here. And John Templeton had a great quote on this. Sir John Templeton was one of the greatest investors of the 20th century. And he said, "I believe in being a conscientious investor. When people wish to sell, I oblige them and I buy. And when people wish to buy, I oblige them and I sell." And that kind of defines the concept when the overall market is doing something that we consider to be silly. Well, let them be silly and we'll profit from it. That's kind of the nature of investing. And you mentioned the GDP numbers coming in as a negative.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first quarter... And we mentioned this last week as a side note that I expected the GDP numbers to get revised into a negative, that mm-hmm. we would have shrinkage for the first quarter. And although that's not what I'm going to get laughed out of the economic circles by calling it shrinkles. That's
a better
name.
That's
we
better.
Use that. But shrinkage is not the right term. It's negative growth, as if that is not shrinkage.
Negative growth is silly.
Yes. Yeah, so we had a 0.7% negative downturn. And there are a series of factors that led to that. All of them we talked about last week, but I'm going to rephrase them again. And basically, we had a lot of really snowy weather in the Northeast. We had a lot of snow in the Northeast. Boston was socked in, and that took several weeks off of their production. At the same time, we had weather events happening in the north of the country and other places. And we had a big problem on the West Coast with our dock workers. Both the management and the union were being silly with each other. And that caused a huge amount of drop. Just as an example of that, in the numbers that we got back from GDP... and I'm pulling them up as we speak, the biggest component in the shrinking of our GDP was in import-export. Our lack of being able to import and make profit there and being able to export and make profit there was the biggest single piece of the pie when we had a pie shrinking. So let's see here.
I've got
energy prices is the other one. Mm-hmm. And this is a big one. When we're exporting, the biggest thing that we export by and large is oil. And we've been a net exporter for a while. And that export, we had a drop in the price. Well, that means that we made less money in it. You throw in the fact that we have bad weather and then the West Coast port strikes, that's the big thing. It's something that, you know, if I was talking about it last week and we were talking about it in the first quarter of the year, it was not a sign that the economy is weak. It's three completely random events happening in the same quarter. And those being energy prices dropping, bad weather, and a West Coast port strike.
Well, there's a little gleam of golden light in the middle of the GDP report. Corporate profits, this is the first line in the paragraph in the Wall Street Journal, U.S. corporate profits rebounded in the first quarter of the year.
We saw... 3.7% from a year ago.
Okay, I've got 3.1. Okay.
Yeah, I've got 3.7.
But the issue is that, let's just call it, okay, 3.1, 3.7, let's call it 3 for a second.
So we've got a 9-year high
and
pending home sales.
Right. The issue is that... Actually, it was his profits after tax without inventory evaluation and capital consumption adjustments, which gets a little complicated, advanced 3.1 in the first quarter. So what you're obviously including all that other stuff in there, so you get 3.7.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the point. If, let's just say we had a 3%, and when I annualize, this is what we do. This is only one quarter. But if we annualize that, that means corporate profitability in the United States is growing by about 12% a year. And while you may not like corporations and you may not like executives in corporations, corporations by definition are what make up the stock exchange. And when you have a 12% growth in profitability, that's earnings. In a year's time, if the market at this moment is fairly priced, which a lot of people seem to think it is, then that would indicate that if we just kept on doing very poorly like we did in the first quarter, that we would probably see about a 12% rise in the stock markets over the next year, which is probably about what we're going to see in the next year. So
right.
One of the things that we love to do is be afraid of something.
You said this last week, and it's a big piece of the final remaining piece here, is that seasonal adjustments done by the Bureau of Economic Analysis probably need to be relooked at. Because if we look at first quarter GDP numbers going back, and I'm pulling that up right now, quite a good number of years, the first quarter GDP numbers look horrible.
They're an abnormally low.
Yeah.
But they're not predictive, because by the third quarter, you have abnormally high GDP numbers.
And what that means is that first quarter is being misrepresented. Misrepresented. It's up there with strategic.
So we had a misrepresented shrinkle in the first quarter.
It's a misrepresented shrinkle. And if other economists can make up words and sound academic, we should too.
We are close enough to Crawford that we're probably being infected by
it. Could
this
be.
Okay. Misrepresented crinkle. Is that part of your strategery?
It will be now.
Shrinkle.
Yes. So if we look back last year,
I really like that word shrinkle. I think I'm going to hang on to that word shrinkle.
Last year, the first quarter significantly lower than the rest of the year.
It was a shrinkle. It was a wrinkle, but it was a negative wrinkle as opposed to a positive wrinkle, so it was a shrinkle.
In 2013, the first quarter significantly smaller than the rest of the year. In 2012, the first quarter significantly smaller than the rest of the year. You see the pattern, and it goes back, and we keep saying every year, we say, well, it's because of weather, and it's because of this is and that. It's because after Christmas, people are done spending for a while, except that if you look at our first quarter, the biggest component in what would lead to growth was consumer spending.
Mm-hmm. But the Wall Street Journal identifies consumer spending in the first growth as tepid.
Tepid.
I mean, if they're going to use tepid, you should be able to use shrinkle.
Right. Tepid.
Tepid growth.
I think shrinkle is a new word and should be used regularly.
And I think it might be used with tepid.
I think shrinkle makes a lot more sense than negative growth.
It actually does.
Yes, but it sounds much more academic to put two words that don't really have the same meaning together.
So
growth means positive. So you have a positive negative, it just doesn't make sense.
Basically, the consumer spending tepid is something that is really, really important in this.
I'm trying to go back to a time when the first quarter wasn't drastically lower. In 2009, the first quarter was slightly more than the second quarter, but both quarters were not really healthy.
No, yeah, and that was a year in which the bottom was falling out of the
economy. Everything was bad. So 2008 was horrible. First quarter was not good as compared to the other. I mean, you go back 2007. It's consistent enough that the BEA should be taking some measurements.
And this is a key here.
Changes.
The consumer, I don't remember, the actual buying index for people I don't remember the name of it. It's a survey.
It's called a survey. I don't think it's legal to buy people.
Well, there's a survey that the Federal Reserve relies on quite a lot, which is I think it's Consumer Expenditure Survey, but I may have the words a little bit off. Basically, they do a survey.
Of people, not of buying.
A survey of what
people that are buying.
Yeah, what they're actually spending money on.
Mm-hmm.
And then they look at the prices of the things that they're on which they are spending money during a given quarter. And we saw year over year, somewhere, depending on where you are in the economic scale, somewhere between a 0.2 and a 0.5% decline in prices over the last year. That's deflation. Now, it may not fit the classic economic definition of inflation, which includes a lot of things, but if you're in a really, really, really strong tropical storm, and the fact that it's not a hurricane, but it has winds of hurricane force, the difference is irrelevant for you personally. It's just not that big. And that's what we have in this case, is the fact that we have declining prices in the United States is depressing economic activity, which causes more price decline, which to me is a pretty good definition of deflation. What happens is, when they say every survey I've read about consumer spending, which is about 70% of our economy, suggests that people are deferring purchasing large ticket items.
Yeah.
In some cases, small ticket items.
You can just ask yourself, listener, and this is something we give as a survey regularly to people that we talk to. When you're going to go buy something like a refrigerator, a dishwasher,
a car,
television, large screen, generally people say, well, I'm going to wait till the end of the year when the sales hit. That is waiting, putting off the expenditure to a point when the price mm-hmm. drops, and we expect it to happen. That is the definition of deflation.
I've been thinking about buying a new computer, new personal computer.
Should probably wait a little bit because the prices are going to drop. So.
Right. That's exactly the point. And the same thing is true, crazily enough, on automobiles. The automobile construction ramped up in the last year, and more people are being put to work. It's up like 17% year over year. I'm sorry, it was up to 17 million. We produced last quarter 17 million cars in the United States. And that sounds really, really good until you realize that the rate of automobile manufacturing in the United States is all the way to where it was in 2001.
Woohoo!
So,
breaking new records of old past labor work.
This is one of the things that's a fundamental shift in this economy in the 21st century over what we've seen in the past. And that is, it's complex. There's nothing simple about it. You can buy more car for fewer hours of work today than at any point in history. So the price of car, and I realize that sounds like a strange name, price of car, the price of the various things you get when you get a car is actually declining. Now, yes, you can spend $35,000 for a car, and there was a time when you could have bought it for two. But when you factor in inflation, which has been pretty substantial over that time period, you realize that cars, a given car that had the same characteristics, the same things in it that the car that you would have bought in, let's say, 1970, today you can purchase that car for, after inflation, significantly less money than you could have purchased it in 1970. Cars are declining in value. And the other thing about automobiles, and this is a big thing, as I have discussed the experience that people have when they buy vehicles, a really big thing is how long does that automobile last? And in the 1970s, the life expectancy of an automobile was approximately 4 years and approximately 100,000 miles. At 100,000 miles, it was a piece of junk, and anything over 4 years old was falling apart. Well, today, we in recent discussions with people, they're talking about the fact that many people have 200,000 miles or more on the automobile they're currently driving, and they're perfectly happy with it. You can look at some of the older automobiles, and you can see that their paint jobs are deteriorating. And you can look at some of the better vehicles that people buy today, or they bought in the last 5 years. And you see that the paint job looks just as good 5 years after the automobile was purchased as it did the day it was purchased, presuming that the automobile has been washed, obviously. But so what we have is a combination of factors that are causing a major economic and socioeconomic shift here in the United States. One of them is the fact that we're building better products, and they're lasting longer, and they cost less in terms of number of working hours, number of average working hours in the United States to buy that whatever it is that you're buying. The end result is that we're selling fewer of those items. We're selling fewer cars. We're, like I said, despite the fact that the economy and the population has grown significantly since 2001, that was actually quite a while ago. That was like 14 years ago. Whoa.
How did that happen?
I don't know. But the fact that in 14 years, the economy and the population of the United States has grown and the number of drivers has grown substantially.
Some other things
that
have happened.
But we're only buying as many automobiles today. And we're doing catch-up, too.
Right.
Because for a long time, people just didn't buy automobiles.
So some of that has to do with the fact that in 2009, if you look at the oil prices, we're slightly higher now than we were then, but not much more. When we're talking about the last 10 years or so, we've got lots of higher gas issues where people are trying to figure out what kind of car to buy. If you go back to the late 90s and the 80s, people didn't question what car they were going to buy. They bought the brand that they bought before. And when the oil prices started going up, people started questioning. Toyota made a big input into our market, and they're selling a lot of cars. They're part of the reason why car sales are up, but because they made gas-efficient vehicles. And well, now the American companies are doing the same thing.
This is the point, though, that is crucial to understand in all of this. While the economy is shifting and we are spending less money in many ways, the corporate profits in the United States at the end of the first quarter hit all-time records. And again, you may complain that the corporations are too profitable, and I don't know if you want to complain about that.
Who would complain about that?
The 99%ers, I guess, would be complaining that corporation profits are too high and the executives are paid too much, and they just been generally corporations are bad. Okay,
right. Well, that's the left leaning side of the audience would probably say that.
So, but this is the point. If you want a representation of capitalism at its purest or most pure, depending on your choice there, corporations constitute the most pure form of just plain old get-in-your-face capitalism that I know of.
Right. And corporations
and
represent
their profits,
people.
And their profits, despite the fact that the consumer spending is tepid and the GDP is down, and the European Union may fall apart momentarily, and the euro may collapse, and Russia may invade somewhere or another new, other than where they've already invaded, and you just list all this bad news, and then right there is this little jewel in the middle of it all, which is corporate profits are up 12%.
Yeah.
Now, 9.2%. Corporate profits are up 9.2% from 1 year ago.
Where did the 12% come from?
I just said just 3%. If we assume 3% for the quarter and we run it out for four quarters, numerical combination. 12.
Yeah.
But we're up 9.2% from a year ago. And that is a triumph of capitalism and a big flag waving out there that things will get better in the future because, and I hate to put it this way, the president, I think his name was Smith at the time, but the president of General Motors once said, what's good for the United States is good. Now, the only half of his quote is normally recited, but he said, what's good for the United States is good for General Motors. What's good for General Motors is good for the United States.
Right.
And there was if you talk about corporate America, there's a lot that can be said that would suggest that that is the truth. And as much as we may not like it, again, because people who work for corporations particularly or who feel like they're victimized by corporations seem to have forgotten the fact that the essence of capitalism is competition. And the essence of that is an adversarial relationship between members of the public, members, customers, and employees, and the corporation itself.
I would even say, I would take that a step in a different direction. I would say the essence of capitalism is providing value that other people can't provide at the same price.
Right.
So if you're talking about a car, it is possible to build your own car in a garage.
It is?
Yes. You can get all the parts and you can put them all together. You can even build the parts yourself, or you can send to Mexico for the parts. So there's a lot of things. You can do it. But the value that you get out of it for the money that you spend is not great. And then the next step is competing in price. So if General Motors can make a car cheaper than you can, and therefore you're willing to pay General Motors, you feel like, all right, this is a lot easier than making my own car.
And it's less expensive.
And less expensive, a lot less expensive. Well, then the next step is, all right, General Motors is now competing with the other people that can build a car cheaper than you can. And that competition is good.
Yeah.
But even closer to the core of all of this, and it actually touches on a Supreme Court issue that was decided a few years back, is that corporations are little republics where you get to buy a vote. You buy in a share, and you are then forever able to vote that share in the corporation.
So, and, yes, go ahead.
Whether or not we'll be able to actually take this call, is it, we have a call coming in.
We have a call on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air, and you probably can't hear us on the phone, but go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Question on China. Their stock market took a 6% hit, and there was an article in the Wall Street today about being very cautious about investing over there. They've got ghost towns of new construction.
Yes.
Or new apartments. Is the Chinese dream over? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I don't know.
That's kind of like the American dream being over.
I don't know that the Chinese dream is over, but I do know that the Chinese stock market is nuts.
Yeah.
It's like the Shanghai Index, it was down 6%, is up like 145% for 1 year.
This is a perfect segue, actually. I was talking about a republic, companies being a republic, and you get to buy a vote. That's not quite true in China. You get a vote, but sometimes it doesn't matter.
Well, In the Chinese society in general, you have the option of either voting for or against,
against
the candidate.
Against may equate to jail time.
Right.
So in a corporation, let's kind of look at China here. Well, let me finish the corporation side in the United States, then we'll hit China because it's a good comparison. The United States Supreme Court ruled a few years back that to limit the free speech of a corporation was unconstitutional. And a lot of
that was actually only a few months ago.
Well, they actually, the first piece of it was a few years ago, and they've said some other things since then, like the Home Depot thing they said recently. But when they're talking about political donations, you can't limit the free speech of the corporation. When you're talking about religious beliefs in healthcare, then the corporation also has free speech. So there's been several decisions that said corporations are people. And the left wing says that this is horrible. Corporations aren't people. They're a stack of paper. That's like saying the United States is a stack of paper.
It is.
It is.
It's not even a very deep stack.
Yeah, it's kind of a curled up stack that's not curled up anymore. It's put up on display somewhere. The original's not. It's somewhere hidden away.
And they bury it every night.
Right. The Constitution is a stack of paper, if you put it that way. But that's not what the United States is. It's the things that are represented on that paper. And a corporation is directly voicing the opinions of the people that own it, just like a union is directly, and the folks on the left don't want a limitation on the amount of money that unions can spend on political advertisements. They just want it on corporations.
Right.
The reality is that a union is a co-op, which is a form of corporation, and
unions are actually incorporated in most cases.
Yeah, they are corporations. They're just owned by the people that work there. That's fine. That's great.
And so is Southwest Airlines.
To say that a corporation doesn't have the power of free speech would say that the people that own the corporation can't talk, and that's unconstitutional. When we're talking about the profits of corporations being up, and yes, there is a bunch of the big media bunch is a technical term. I'll try to keep my layman's terms going. I'll go back to shrinkle again.
Right. Okay. That's good.
The fact that corporations have the right to free speech, as has been given, as stated, it's not really given by the Supreme Court. They're just saying these are people in a group. This is basically what the Constitution was written for. When you have free assembly, and they've done it in a way that is so legal that they have all the paperwork that says they're free assembly, and they put money behind it. It's the same as a church in some ways, and without the religious connotations.
I don't know. I think it's closer to being a church.
Churches are often corporations as well.
Well,
they're just 501c3.
Yeah, and I actually think that, never mind. Corporation is just a church with a different God.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So not necessarily even a different God, because they could, like Home Depot was in the decision there. They have the same God that a church would. They're looking at it
money.
From that money. Well, wait a minute. No. You know what I mean.
I do know what you mean.
And the idea here is that all of us have to make a living. And a lot of us are employed by corporations. I'm not. You're not. We're employed by our clients. But that concept of the number of clients that we have that are employed by corporations is pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that the 1% versus the 99%, there is a pay gap. But that pay gap is actually right now getting smaller. It got a lot bigger during the recession, and that's kind of normal in big recessions. And it's one of those things that people talk about as the biggest problem in the United States. And all of that is leading up to the answer to the question, is the Chinese dream over? The Chinese have done a really amazing job of orchestrating their emergence from the Dark Ages, from the times of no medicine, no education, and using animals for labor.
And they still do use animals for labor.
Right. They're orchestrating a shift from standing in a rice paddy to sitting in a factory to sitting behind a computer, which is something that we've done. We just did it over a much longer period. They're doing it over a much shorter period. And that means that if they do it too fast, they have to wait for themselves to catch up, because you cannot educate the entire population from standing behind oxen to sitting at a computer coding in C#. The wait period, they're building infrastructure, and that's a big thing that they're doing that we've neglected, as we've seen recently in Texas.
But they
have a lot more infrastructure to build.
They're starting to hit a wall on this.
Yeah, and the reality is that they have grown too fast, and now they have to wait. They have to wait for themselves to catch up.
And there's a lot of uncertainty. No one has ever transitioned an economy from a medieval feudal structure into a modern capitalist democratic structure as fast as the Chinese are trying to do it. And you could say, well, their democracy, they really don't have democracy. You're right, they don't.
They're gradually
introducing certain elements of democracy. However, if you consider they're trying to accomplish in a relatively short period of time what took us 400 years to do, with accompanying total economic collapses on several occasions during that 400-year period.
And large
huge wars.
Internal wars, not just...
Yeah.
And by 400 years, we don't just mean the United States. We mean the transition starting in England with the Bank of England and moving forward throughout, England having to fight their own civil wars in the process, and then the United States having to fight civil wars. All of this to determine who has what rights for property, who has what rights for intellect and for voting and for property. And
when there's an anniversary next month of what started all of that.
An anniversary of...
800-year anniversary of the signing of the Magna Carta next month. And there's And basically the Magna Carta originated a thought process that said that equality of ownership and equality of people and freedom are all the same thing.
Right. And that was written into our Constitution. In order to vote, you had to own property. Since then, we have converted from that. And the Chinese have done it a lot faster.
And when Virginia started up its and began the process that led to the revolution, the American Revolution, the American War of Independence, the fundamental issue was what they called the Old Constitution. Well, the Old Constitution, which, by the way, was written into the charter of the state of Virginia, was the Magna Carta. I think it's Pennsylvania that the actual symbol for the colony and now the state of Pennsylvania is a man holding, I believe it's a sword and the in one hand and the Magna Carta in the other. And this is a fundamental shift in the history of humanity. Well, it's been 800 years we've been working on this thing, and it's really been in the last 400 years that we've taken it seriously. And the Chinese are trying to accomplish this all in about less than 100 year period, which is just, if they can pull it off, it will be astonishing. Because usually this involves periods of chaos and collapse and war, repeated periods of chaos, collapse, and war.
And they've skipped a lot of those, but they still have the opportunity of not skipping the next one.
But we actually need to do commercials, because this is a for-profit commercial radio station. So, and we have to have Ed Laughlin have his say in our program. I mean, he's a nice guy, and he wants you to all get divorces as soon as possible. So we're going to start with that, and we're going to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure. And it's been an exciting day, an exciting week. This is Jeff, and I spent two days of the week in a series of continuing education classes that were actually educational.
Yeah, it's strange that sometimes we actually have continuing education that teaches us something.
Learned a lot of things about how somebody manages money and about the theory of investment management that some of the things I vaguely knew and became intimately familiar with. And that's really, I'm really excited about that. That's it's nice to know that it's actually very, very pleasant in a peculiar way to work in a field where new discoveries are being made and have been made that have been validated recently.
Right. That are actual science.
Yeah.
That there was a time when investing was considered an art form, and it still is for a massive amount of people that try to do it. But there is science behind it, and there's real science that is measurable. And I mean, you're following the same methodology as physics. You find something, and then you try to disprove your own hypothesis. And if you can't do it, and you tell everybody else to try to do it, then it becomes a theory.
Mm-hmm. And it's just... found some new and interesting and different and unusual things, and had some things that I was vaguely aware of that were shown to be a little more significant than I thought. And so it was really a pleasant but exhausting several days of sitting in classes in a 23rd century building.
And next week we're going to be in Florida in a probably another 23rd century building, being talked at by two former secretaries of the cabinet, one of defense and one of state, and by the former head of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke.
Right, and we will be right near Fantasyland.
Yes, right next to a place that we're going to be in Orlando, which has a mouse infestation problem that's been going on for many decades. The mice there are
huge.
Huge.
Size of human beings.
Their ears are the size of human heads.
Right.
It is absolutely phenomenal that pest control has gotten that far behind.
They
live in castles there. That's how big the mice are.
We're kind of short on time for this hour, but one of the things I do want to discuss a little bit is why there is so much, and I mentioned this at the beginning of the program, why there is so much angst over the potential for Greece to leave the Eurozone. I've continued to do more research on this and why, for example, Secretary Liu, when the Treasury Secretary of the United States
says to
publicly
Europe,
warns Europe,
"Hey guys, be careful over there. You're doing something stupid.
This is extremely dangerous." And you look at the size of the Greek GDP and say if they left,
tiny,
it would be
Why would that be a problem?
A far smaller impact than any of the hurricanes that we've had recently that hit the United States or have on the United States economy. So,
right.
So why are they so upset about it?
Because it's a hurricane that can lead to a lot of other hurricanes almost immediately.
And so there's a lot of things in the world to be concerned about, and that's good. A bull market climbs a wall of worry.
If we stop worrying about something, then it's time to start selling.
Right. The economy is still recovering in some ways from the recession of 2009. I call it the panic of 2008. The market has...
I think it was a longer panic than that.
They name panics historically, if you go back through history...
It's just one-year panic.
For instance, the panic of 1837 resulted in a Great Depression that lasted 1845, but it's still called the panic of 1837. The panic of 1873 resulted in what they called at that time the Great Depression, and yet it's still called the panic of 1873. So the market versus the economy, I think... It's really hard to describe.
The Great Recession was started by the panic of 2008.
Yes.
It
coincided with the panic of 2008.
There was a lot of shrinkle involved.
Yeah, this was a major shrinkle. I like that term. I really think you've coined a good term.
I think
there.
Wrinkle and shrinkage, put that
it
together,
goes
and
right
you
in there.
Wrinkle.
Right, it goes right in there with strategery, which I actually heard used twice in conversation, strategery.
I think it's a new word.
Yes.
I think it is
George
quite...
Bush.
There is the word precedent is appropriate here.
And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is a radio presentation, in case you didn't know that. If you're listening to the radio, you may have thought you were just hallucinating. It is also the name of an investment advisory firm that does evidence-based investing that is based in Salado, Texas, and does so for fees only and doesn't get paid under the table or
over the table
or anything like that.
We get paid through our bank.
Yes. And
no tables
involved. From our clients. And if you would like to contact us off the air, you're certainly welcome to do so. Of course, this is a weekend, so there's voicemail during the week. There are live people there. Locally, it's 947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can reach us by email at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com or thepersonalwealthcoach.com.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.